just wanted to note for the record that, you know, we're requesting that this be treated confidentially pursuant to the confidentiality agreement that we have from your offices.
Sure.
Thanks.
Mr. Hutchings, I'm sure your counsel has told you a little bit about us and our inquiry, but I will just give the opening statement that we always give, which is that the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is a bipartisan commission established by the United States Legislature in May of last year to examine the causes of the financial crisis that both happened both globally and specifically in the United States. And the statute that enabled the commission asks it to look at institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. AIG falls into that category, and specifically AIG had significant problems related to its securities lending business, which is the purpose of our call with you today. So with that being said, please, if you could, just for openers, give us your professional and educational background.
Okay. Started working. I left school in 1984, went straight in to work for Barclays Bank, and then after 4 years moved to Glanmore Benson Securities, working in the back office.
What was the name of the securities firm? I'm sorry.
Glanmore Benson Securities.
Could you spell the first word there?
Market Bank. Yes, sure. KLEINWORT.
Kleinwort Benson Securities. Okay, thanks.
That's right. Working in the back office there in 1988, I was asked to join a colleague in the back office working on the securities borrowing function for the firm. So that's where my securities lending experience started. A couple of years later, I moved to Security Pacific National Bank, where I, with the same person I worked with at Kleinwort, worked with setting up the London Securities Lending Agency business. It was very small at the time. And then very shortly after, I was offered a job working for Oppenheimer & Co. in London. Working on their international securities lending desk and acting as a intermediary. I was there for 7 years before having an opportunity to join AIG in very much a startup role at the time, and we'll obviously go on to that in a moment. And I've been here ever since.
And that was in 1997?
In 1997.
Okay. And so since you joined AIG...
Was he finished?
Yeah, I'm sorry?
I'm sorry if you weren't finished. Please keep going.
Well, you asked about quite a lot of qualifications. I didn't know if you wanted me to carry on with that.
Sure.
Currently IMC, which is the Investment Manager Certificate, qualified in the UK. I also have my Business Management Diploma. Back with the Open University here in the UK, and in I suppose it was around 2004-5 I did my Series 7 NASD Series 7 and Series 24.
Thank you. Could you take us through, since you started at AIG, what roles you held at AIG from 1997 to today?
Sure. I joined AIG very much as like the second person in the door to help wind back slightly. The company took the view to set up, bring securities lending internal and set up an internal securities lending agency business. They hired a gentleman by the name of Peter Adamczyk to run the product globally. He hired me to run their trading activity. There was no real activity at that time. So, you know, my role was to very much set up the trading desk in London and lend out AIG's assets that we actually had either in the program or were added to the program over time. Over in about, I think it was 2003, he gave me responsibility for a Hong Kong desk, because by that time we'd set up a Hong Kong trading desk. And I also got responsibility for the US trading desk around about the same sort of time. So I had responsibility for the trading activity of the securities lending team. Just to be clear, when we refer to trading, I think I'm just making this clear because it's come up a number of times. What I'm referring to is the lending out of the securities, negotiating rebates and agreeing the duration and the fees with the counterparts. Also, I suppose my role was when we had. We operated under two agents, AIG Global Securities Lending Corp and AIG Global Securities Lending Ireland. The US agent, AIG Securities Lending Corp, was the agent for the US US insurance companies, and the Ireland agent was for non-US insurance companies or affiliates or third parties, I should say. And I was a director of both those companies.
Each of these companies had separate boards of directors, or?
Yes, they did. Okay. Although the boards of directors were made up, you know, there were a couple of us that were, I think Peter and myself were directors of both boards.
So, first you said the company took the view to bring the securities lending business in-house. Prior to 1997, how long had AIG, to your knowledge, had a securities lending business that was operated externally?
AIG, I believe, and I'd have to go back to my notes of the records, but I believe AIG started lending securities back in 91. Through a third party called Wall Street Portfolio Advisors. They were an agent that lent out the treasuries of, I believe, five AIG insurance companies. And that business carried on until 1999 when we terminated that arrangement and brought the lending of those companies' assets in-house. So it goes back as far as that period of time. There was also activity in 95 where AIG had third-party UCITS funds, and those UCITS funds were lent out. They're registered in Dublin in Ireland. They were lent out in 95. And there was some activity that I believe went on around about the same period of lending some Japanese assets through a third-party hedge fund. And that arrangement was also terminated around 98, 99.
And were those securities that were lent out from the insurance companies?
The Japanese ones, yes. They were from one of the Asian life companies.
And the one in Ireland?
Well, they were third-party UCITS money, so AIG predominantly had a lot of seed money in those funds. But they were, obviously, third-party money, retail, institutional money that went into those funds.
I see. So you said that your role was to set up the trading desk, and you clarified that trading, as you are referring to it, means lending out securities and negotiating
correct,
the terms
yeah.
of that lending out. So may I ask, did you have any role in the investment of the cash proceeds from that securities lending business?
No, none at all. We treated the business as sort of like two sides of a coin. The one side where obviously securities were being lent out, and then it was what type of collateral do you receive? it's very much down to the model, and you know, you can read this in lots of places, and I'm sure you have, that securities lending can be done in numerous different ways. But the model that we used to adopt was one where we took in non-cash collateral. And I'm saying used to, this was prior to, you know, when we first got started, when we took over the some of the previous lending activity. The Japanese one, for example, was lent versus Japanese government bonds. And we just earned a fee off that. But clearly the model that we adopted was one of cash reinvestment. And in 99, we took the decision to set that, you know, agree to invest the cash collateral, or take in cash collateral, and then invest that. And that, the way we, and I come back to the two sides of the coin, we then would have taken the cash collateral from lending those securities, passed it on to our investment advisors to manage the investment of the process.
And so, let me just see if I get this straight. So you work for AIG Global Securities Lending. Do you work for the Ireland entity or the U.S. entity or both?
Well, let's just clarify that one more time and confuse it as well. I actually work for the UK investment management arm in London. That's who my employment comes under. I provide services to the securities lending entities as under a service agreement. So myself and my colleagues here in London acted as agents for the securities lending agent, providing trading services.
Okay, so if you could tell me a little bit about your interaction with people on the investment management side.
Sure. I mean, we spoke, let's see, where's the best place to start? Obviously, the investment managers, we had investment managers in London and New York. We had short-term investment managers in the US, as well as long-term investment managers. And then in the long-term bucket, we had investment managers that dealt with corporate bonds, and we had those that dealt with asset-backed securities. In London, we had investment managers that dealt with both the short-term and the long-term, but mainly the long-term was corporate bonds. Is that clear so far?
Yes.
Okay, so our interaction was on a very regular basis. I mean, we got to a point, and I don't know where, what specific point in time, but we would have a weekly call to discuss the cash flows from security lending, what was going on with regards to any lending activity that we were either seeing issues with brokers, or the fact that we might have to return collateral, and to make the investment managers aware that they, you know, not to go spending any available cash, might be an example, or the fact that, which is more likely the case, is that we were trying to lend and raise more cash, and that they had to therefore put the money to work by certain investments under the whatever the guidelines were at the time, and to get feedback from them as to how the market was with regards to the investments. And how they were progressing on the investments they were making. So it was a fairly regular dialogue that would go on, and that was probably the interaction that we would have on the most regular basis.
Who did you interact with that would have the most knowledge on what the proceeds, the collateral, actually got invested in? So, and let me be specific. Who was the ABS person in the U.S.?
Okay, well, there was a bunch of different people over a period of time. So let me start with the guy who ran the desk was a person by the name of Greg Matthews. The person who did the most the asset-backed purchases, probably up to, and again, the time he left, which I think was around 2004, but, you know, let me be clear, it was a chap called Anatoly Berman.
Anatoly Berman?
And Anatoly Berman, yeah. It's A-N-A-T-O-L-Y. And then Berman, which I think is B-U-R-M-A-N.
Thanks.
And then he left to go elsewhere, and a chap called Mike Rieger.
How do you spell that last name?
R-E-I-G-E-R.
Okay.
And he was very much the, I suppose, through the biggest growth, he was the man in the hot seat. We'd have, you know, as a group, we'd have a weekly call, and Mike Rieger would always be involved and provide updates. Following Mike's, Mike Rieger left, and again, I'm not sure on the precise date, but I think it was something like 2006, maybe 2007, we'd have to check, but, then there was a number of guys took on the responsibility, and Jason D'Angelo was one, and I'm not sure on the other two guys, because they weren't around they were quite in the background. But I could get you those names for you.
Sure. Stacey, just want to let you know that we're going to want to talk to somebody who was actually involved on the investment side. I do have a few more, and my colleagues, I'm sure, have additional ones as well, but I have a few more questions that I just want to get clarification from you, Mr. Hutchings. If you could talk to us a little bit about...
Feel free to call me Mark.
Oh, thank you, and you can call me Dixie. If you could give us a sense of the proceeds that you would get from lending out securities, what did AIG charge to lend those securities?
Sure. Well, it was very fairly straightforward. We worked on a share of the gross revenue of 50-50 between ourselves and the insurance company, and then we would, out of the agent's 50% would come all the costs. So we would pay the investment management charge, and we'd pay all the custody and clearance activity as well, and obviously heating, light, and salaries, and etc. The 50-50 split was, maybe I can rephrase it a bit differently. The revenue obviously came in from the income from the investments. We then had to pay the rebate to the borrowers. That was the use of the cash. We had to pay them a fee, and it was the difference which we deemed as being the gross revenue.
So wait a minute. Let me just tell you how I understood it. And obviously this is wrong, but I was under the impression that AIG would take, for example, make it really simple, a security with a par value of $100 and would lend that out to a securities lending counterpart for $102 in cash. Is that not how it worked?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
It is how it worked.
Okay, that is how it worked. So the 102 would get invested and say earns, you're going to use silly numbers right now, but say earns 10% that investment. We would have agreed with the borrower to give us that 102, that we'd pay them 5% as a rebate for the use of the cash. And the 5% difference, what's left, is then split 50-50 between the AIG insurance company and the lending agent.
So when you say
end up with 2.5 and the insurance company 2.5.
So this is assuming that the $102 earns 10% because of what the AIG investment managers have invested it in.
Correct.
And the agreement would be
go ahead.
And the agreement would be with a counterparty that you would split the upside from that investment 50-50.
No, there's no agreement with the counterparty. The counterparty, my process on the trading side was to, for example, find a bond. It might be a U.S. Treasury that the counterpart wanted to borrow. And the rate to borrow that security, they would be willing to pay us. Let's say there was a fee they'd be willing to pay. what we've done is we've reversed it around. We're saying, well, we'll take the fee away from whatever is the, we used to call the risk-free rate. So it was Fed Funds, was the Fed Funds Open, was the risk-free rate. That was the benchmark. And we would, if the borrower or the counterpart was willing to pay a 1% fee and Fed Funds was 2%, we would return a rebate of 1% to the borrower, to the counterpart.
While we're on this topic,
that's still confusing.
No, it's simple. There's a rent on borrowing the securities, this fee.
Correct.
And you calculate the rebate as the market rate of interest less that rent or fee.
That's correct.
What are some of the range of haircuts you would use for lending out equities versus corporate bonds versus asset-backed securities?
Okay, well, there were two different haircuts we used. One was 102 and one was 105. 102 was same currency. 105 was cross currency. Did I say that right? 102,
yes.
Same currency, 105, cross currency. We had very, very little equities, and any equities we did, we would do at, again, using that basis, we would lend, if it was an international equity, we would only ever take in US dollars, so we would lend versus 105.
Really?
If it was a US equity, we would do 102, which was standard market practices, and it was same currency. If it was a fixed income bond, again, 102 if it was same currency, 105 if it was cross currency. This is where the numbers changed was when we got into the crisis mode in March 08, when borrowers or counterparts put pressure on us because of the pressure that they were experiencing in the marketplace to reduce down our haircuts. And, you know, we had the option to either accept or decline. If we declined, the concern was, and the very real risk, was that we would be required to close out the loan and pay out the collateral that we were holding.
Wow.
So in summary, it was 102 or 105.
Well, along these lines, then, what are the maturity of these security loans?
The majority of the loans we did were on term. What I mean by term is we'd, like, go out 1 month. It was a rolling agreement with the counterparts that we would lend to them for the period of 1 month, and we'd set the rate, and we'd reset that rate in 1 month's time, or we would, renew the trade and renew the rate. And the majority of the time, that is exactly what happened.
And you appraise the value of the collateral daily?
Daily. We did mark-to-markets daily.
Okay. So there were margin calls within the month?
Okay. Margin calls went on with the month, or when we cleaned up interest. Again, we looked at the level, and the idea is that every single security doesn't stay at exactly 102, but what we did is we said overall the book must stay at 102, and therefore we would, some securities would go up, some down, but as long as we were always at 102 or higher, we were, collateralized.
Was 1 month the longest tenor?
We did go out 3 months. Some of the trades we did in the international book, we went out 3 months. I have a vague recollection of doing a 6 month many, many months years ago, but I don't think we kept that on for very long. But it was the standard operating practice was 1 month tenor, possibly some 3 months. And again, it was, I think the plan was, is whether that was good around interest rates.
But the 102...
Majority was all 1 month.
I'm sorry, keep going.
Sorry, no, the vast, vast majority, probably 97% were all 1 month.
If you needed
But, we did do some open trades as well, which were which were mainly the, what we deemed as being the specials.
And what open means you, it's day-to-day?
Yeah, day-to-day. You know, we could close it out, you know, they could close it out, and we were fine with that. But we had a very small percentage, you know, 1 or 2% would have been specials. The majority of our book was what we deemed general collateral, hence why we were able, we wanted to, and again, we were very much doing sort of a repo-style practice. We wanted to have the use of the cash. We wanted to lock that up so we didn't have to pay people back on a regular basis.
I mean, if the contracts are all one-month tenors, how do you guarantee that? I mean, how do you know that that's how it's going to work?
The agreement between when we booked the trade with the counterpart, the agreement was very much, you know, bilateral. They were we entered into them. They would even probably suggest us, could we do a 1 month trade, and we would say yes, this is fine. Or likewise, we would just, you know, it was administratively it was a lot easier for both sides, and you know it was effectively. It worked, you know, by the bilateral agreement that entered into on the transaction.
Well, I mean, I still don't understand, because it sounds like it worked well from both sides administratively and maybe for other reasons to do these for 1 month, but AIG wanted the use of the cash for longer than 1 month. So my question is... How do you know you're going to have the cash accessible for longer than 1 month to give you comfort to invest in longer tenor securities?
Sure, I think it's very the way we sort of look at it is, and maybe I take a different angle to explain this, is that the way we lent at AIG was we had, I don't know, let's say 20 insurance companies. They had assets available to lend of over 100 billion. We would put all of those securities we treat as like a commingled pool, and therefore we could, you know, our overall balance might have been 50 billion, but we could have lent more securities and brought in more cash any time we wanted to, because we had 100 billion available to ourselves, or we had 100 billion in total available to lend. So we were able to agree that with the counterpart, knowing that if the counterpart wanted to close out, we would, and we didn't want to sell an investment or to the that might have been out for 3, 4, 5 years, we could lend more securities and bring in the cash from another counterpart that would be used to return to the other counterpart wanting to close.
I see.
Looked at another way, what was the average time it would take you to sell the securities in your investment portfolio? Were these liquid corporate bonds, very illiquid, bespoke structured securities, or how did that factor into your liquidity management?
Okay, I mean, difficult to answer that question because I wasn't the investment professional was involved. Certainly, the timing-wise, I wouldn't be able to ask. But
I thought that might have been part of the dialogue since you were funding it. I thought that might have come up that they were be interested in the liquidity of what they were funding.
Sure. No, I think the investment guidelines that were used throughout the tenor of the program were always with the view that all the investments that were bought were highly liquid. You know, high credit ratings and highly liquid. And that was always the belief, certainly from my perspective, that these securities could be sold readily, easily, and within a short pace of time. Obviously, with hindsight, is a great thing, and clearly, you know, they became very illiquid, particularly the structured products. And even the corporate bonds, we only have to look at the recent weeks in the current corporate bond market to see how illiquid the markets can be. At the time and before the crisis hit, to me, it was very clear that, you know, we had a very liquid portfolio of highly rated investments. So, you know, that was the understanding I believe, of all the people that were involved up the chain.
The reason we ask is because we notice in the there's a cash collateral investment policy that we're reviewing, and it permits up to 75% of the portfolio to be invested in ABS, and that was up from 60%. And the only credit criteria was tied exclusively to NRSRO rating, and there's no other consideration given to the underlying quality of the collateral.
Right. Well, I mean, I can't comment on that, unfortunately. I mean, the people that wrote the guidelines, or approved the guidelines, were the investment professionals and the people on the credit risk committee. I can understand your question, but the view I think was that asset backs, so long as they were whatever the rating, AAA or even a small part of AA, they were acceptable, and the view was they were liquid. I mean, that was the message down that we were given down from above.
Going back to a couple of things you said earlier, you said every security doesn't stay at 102, but your overall goal was that the book should stay at 102.
That's right.
I don't.
Well, the book with each counterpart, so each client and each counterpart should be at 102.
So, how do you keep the book at 102? I mean, these are securities that you lend to them, and the 102 is based on the value of the securities that you've lent out. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
It's not based on anything about what you've invested in the cash proceeds with.
Not at all. It has nothing to do with the cash collateral side of their things at all.
So once you've lent out these securities, how could you... Go ahead.
Well, sorry, I'm interrupting you. Please go ahead.
Well, my question is, once you lend these securities out to the counterparty, what control do you have over keeping them at an average of 102?
Our books and records will tell us exactly what security has been lent, and it revalues it every day. And we'd obviously know whether what exactly the counterpart has provided, and what we'd need to ask them for if we needed to top up the collateral, and if it dropped down. And obviously we've got a collateral pool that would have all the investments, and they have valuations daily, and they have coupons coming in, and they have rebates going out, and that would be the offsetting entry.
So if the security fell below 102, you would post collateral or a rebate to the counterparty?
Yeah, we would if the value dropped below 102, the counterpart would probably we would ask for more collateral if it dropped below that level, to get us back up to 102. If it was higher, then it was down to the counterpart to request cash back.
Okay. And then I think you said that the numbers started changing in March of 2008 when the crisis hit. Assuming you're talking about the 102.
That's correct.
So what did the numbers change? How did the numbers change starting in March 2008?
Well, it changed in different degrees. We managed to keep the majority of our counterparts appeased at 102. They didn't make noise, and we didn't obviously offer anything up. But we had a couple of counterparts that came to us and said, "You are the only securities lending house we're dealing with, and the rest are all repo counterparts, and we're paying you more cash than the securities we're taking. The securities we're taking. We can't sustain that. We need to move you to 100. And that's when we sort of had to, start evaluating what to do. Internally, we obviously had the requirement with some of our insurance companies to remain at 102%. So there was an agreement made internally to use internal assets in the parent company that was made available to us to allow us to offset the 2% we had to give up to the counterpart to set aside in the event of the counterparts defaulting. we would have 100 from the counterpart and 2% from this these extra assets.
And where were the extra assets coming from?
Well, it's called AIG's Matched Investment Program.
And who were the clients who you wanted to keep who requested this?
Well, the counterparts. The one that comes to mind was JP Morgan in London. We also had, as time went on, in the US, I believe ING were very keen to reduce the margin. We also found that we got a request to go below like 100, especially as we got through into the summer. And I think there was numerous concerns from the counterparts' credit departments. We got requests to go to like 98 to 95. And I think as we got towards September of 08, there were requirements to go to 90 and below. And we had, I think we ended up at like 73 cents in cash for every 100 we lent with Barclays. I think Credit Suisse were at 80 cents for every 100 we lent. We were really held over a barrel because what we didn't want to do was to give out cash or sell and make a lot of big losses. I think that was the strategy from above.
Mark, would it help if you gave them sort of the lay of the land, the bigger picture other than the cash collateral requirements for 2008?
Sorry, I don't think I understand the question.
Well, so just sort of, I guess, what the environment was like when in dealing with the counterparties during this time and sort of what you were trying to accomplish with the program going towards,
sure.
September 2008.
And I actually would love, I would love for you to do that. If I could ask one question just before you do that. Earlier, I think you had said that if AIG has $100 billion in securities, it's lending out $50 billion at any one time. So if somebody comes and wants their cash back, then you could just go out and sell more securities to someone else. Why didn't you invoke that sort of strategy when this started happening?
That's a very good question. The factor is that we did. And then maybe that's where I was going to go, is if I started around about August 2007 when this when I think the crisis first raised its head for us here at in securities lending, and I'd answer that point specifically, I came back from vacation and never heard before, I'd gone on vacation, the two words, subprime, and it was suddenly the big issue, how much subprime did we have in our investment pool, and there was a lot of concern from senior management, and the strategy straight away was don't invest any more of the cash collateral in anything other than overnight time deposits. We need to raise our threshold of actual cash liquidity, and the decision, from management was to, well, you could do it a number of ways. You can sell investments we already have in our collateral account and to raise cash, or we can lend more securities to give ourselves that cushion of comfort. And again, what we're protecting ourselves any of the times was a run on the bank. The fact that we do not want to see everybody suddenly coming in and wanting their money back, because clearly we've obviously got it tied up in investments that may or may not be very quickly sold. At that time, no one knew what the next day was going to bring. So I think the decision to raise liquidity and stop investing was the right one. So I believe our cash amount in our cash account was something like 4%. It was in overnight cash. The target was to get to 20% as soon as possible, without taking too much in losses. And I know the first exercise was communicated to the investment managers to sell anything they can that was a positive gain. And then we'll discuss after that where we go. And I believe the next thing was to, once that had been done, It was to then to look at, you know, anything we could take with limited losses, i.e. a 1-point loss or probably, and then it went to 2-point losses and so forth. But it was always, you know, let's do this strategy and then hold, stop, and then do this strategy. So the investment managers were guided by senior management as to what was the, how they should raise, you know, what sales or how much they should try, losses they should take. Certainly the ability to sell anything, as well, liquidity dried up very much in that period of time in autumn of, or the fall of 2007, and that made it also very difficult to sell anything. So, you know, just to answer that point, just mentioned, you know, one of the other, the main way we raised liquidity on the lending side was to lend more of these securities, and we did have you know, a good surplus of securities available to lend. We had willing counterparts that were willing to do business with us, even in that period of time. And, you know, again, a cost of, we had to pay a rebate, maybe a slightly higher rebate. And especially as we went through 2008, a rebate that was more than we were earning on the investments. So earnings went to negative. So there were losses to the clients from lending the securities, as well as losses from the sale of securities, but it was, you know, all taken with the need to maintain liquidity and not have this run on the bank.
What was, I mean, just sort of stepping back a little bit, can you help me understand what the borrowers, the security borrowers' rationale is for doing this in the first place? Is it just another type of investment strategy?
Sure, Sam.
I think, you know, I'm not a borrower, but I think there's clearly lots of different reasons for borrowing. It could be, I think the majority of the borrowing that went on with us was a financing transaction. They were looking for a quality counterpart with a good return on the cash that could be done on a 1-month basis, and maybe our rate was better than the rest of the street. And, you know, they took the securities, and some securities they could use in other financing transactions, you know, treasuries, agencies, even corporates, they could use and place them elsewhere. But generally, you know, it was a finance attraction. There's obviously arbitrage activity, there's shorting activity, but generally for the activity we were doing, the general collateral, it was a funding financing transaction. Again, very similar to a repo style transaction.
Okay, thanks.
So, look, this is Chris Seifer. If I could ask you just a couple of questions about dealing with the investment side. You mentioned earlier that, you know, as beginning in August of 07 and then I assume getting worse and worse and worse as you got into 08, some of the counterparties were asking for steeper and steeper haircuts. That's correct, isn't it?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Did there come a time when the folks on that you were talking to on the investment side of AIG, did they ever tell you that they were directed to wind down the program?
I don't think so. You know, I know that there was, I mean, I know that there was definite feel that, a feeling within my team that, you know, this was pretty much the end was nigh, but I think there was also a view that we could ride out the storm. And again, you know, no one knew what was going to unfold, and I think the feeling was that the investments were all money good. I kept hearing that phrase a lot of times, and that maybe one of the reasons why we didn't rush to sell more early on, and it was more a case of, let's, you know, sell what we can, but most of this stuff is good, and we'll ride it out, and we'll just meet whatever needs we have to meet. You know, a lot of dialogue didn't really go on between, you know, my level with the investment manager. It went on with, you know, the investment managers and the securities lending folks had the same superiors at the end of the day. Richard Scott was the ultimate manager of both groups, And I think a lot of direction came down from him to the groups from whatever dialogue he'd had with either AIG senior management. And, you know, we heard about it more than, you know, gave that information or had dialogue with the investment managers.
Sure. And just so I'm clear, when you say that you had heard that the investments were money good, that's not to say that they're, that the fair value of those investments has not declined, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, the fair value had declined, but the view was that it was better to hang on to these for the long term, and they'll come good in the long term. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I think there was a view that AIG did not want to sell, across everything across the board.
So did there come a time either in 07 or 08 when you would lend out securities for less than 100 and then have to use those proceeds to pay back other counterparties?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you were losing both on both sides of that deal, right?
Yes, we were.
Right.
A horrible position to be in.
Yes.
I had a couple of
The other option was just much, much bigger. I mean, I think that there was a real sort of wish to try and get through this period without having to make as many sales and losses as possible. And it was better to potentially lose on the lending revenue by paying a negative spread, as we referred to it, and pay out, than to actually have to pay out, cash and close out big chunks of the business.
It would have been a bigger loss to sell the securities that had declined in fair value to pay back the counterparty, right? Right.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned earlier there were two different subsidiaries that were doing the securities lending, and I was wondering if that, and I believe one was registered in the UK and one in the US or some other country, and it was or it was set up for investors from Europe and the other from the US. I assume that's for some regulatory purposes.
It's historical. I think we first of all started out in the US. The company originally was called, there was various different names, but AIG's Global Securities Lending Bermuda was the first one. That was transitioned into AIG Global Securities Lending Corp, a Delaware corporation that I believe was set up in 98. In, I think, around 2000, we had two entities that we lent for out of the U.S. Two entities that we wanted to start lending for, and they were Bermuda-based, and they didn't want to, from a tax point of view, wanted to be outside of the U.S. Or not have, there was totally legitimate reasons. And we looked around and said, could we put this in the UK or where? And our options were really the UK, Ireland, or Hong Kong. And we had legal support and infrastructure in Ireland. So we set up an agent in Ireland. And then once we started lending to those two entities, we then added anything that was not a US entity into that Irish company.
And there, aside from the tax reasons, were there any regulatory differences that were material? Proceeds from the collateral?
I think both regulations are very, regulatory environments are very similar, very strict. We had very clear regulatory dialogue and regulatory reporting in the Ireland company. As we did with the U.S. The U.S. actually became a U.S. broker-dealer, hence why I had to get my licenses, and that was around 2006. And the idea of, slight tangent, the idea of setting up a broker-dealer was to potentially lend to third parties. That was one of the plans, and to also borrow you know, there was potential where we could be actually going out to the street and borrowing to supplement our lending activity.
That's overall bank securities lending, I think. The other thing I wanted to ask you is when you talk about this change in the, if you will, the haircut on your securities lending operation, it occurs to me that for a long time you were getting a preferable deal than what you could have gotten in the repo market. I mean, essentially you're getting a negative haircut initially because they're giving you more cash than the value of the securities that you're lending out to secure it with, right? In other words, instead of discounting the security, the haircut's negative. And then so when the crisis grew, you're economically starting to make more normal sense and that they're discounting the value of the security to lend you cash. And so...
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. That discount of the security, just picking up on that point, I remember Barclays, because they went to 73 cents on the dollar, what they were giving in cash, they used a very, very clear reason for that, was that the securities that we lent them, their view was in the liquid markets of 2008, particularly the September or October, etc., was that they couldn't sell those securities for any more than 73 cents on the dollar. So it made absolute sense that they would only give us cash for that, because that's obviously what they would expect to raise if we went bust. And the other thing, a point about, you know, yes, you know, this was a security lending transaction. The idea was, you know, to enhance yield, to return extra yield to the insurance companies. This wasn't a repo transaction, and in the repo market, you know, it is the flip way. And in fact, most of our counterparts we dealt with were big repo houses, and they continued to push us to say, you know, we need you to go to 100% collateral or margin, zero margin. And we said, no, you know, if you want to continue to borrow from us, unfortunately, these are the rules. You know, it's 102 or nothing. And that was obviously acceptable until we needed to go the other way because we were held over a barrel.
Right. And they paid, in a sense, they initially, they would be willing to kind of work with 100 and 502 because you were highly rated counterparties or because there was something more secure about a securities lending transaction than a repo transaction?
No, I think it's just a case of it's an additional supply. It was big supply. It was a highly rated entity that they were borrowing from, and it was the collateral they liked. And I think all those things made it work for them.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't know. I mean, again, I'd have to ask the counterparts more that question, but I'm only assuming that's how they would, you know, it worked.
But if the same collateral were being repoed at by a lesser known entity and maybe in smaller volumes, you would probably be looking at a much bigger haircut.
You know, the market is very very staid in some respects. You know, 105 and 102, I mean, as I said, I started lending in the securities lending business in 1988, and then it was always 105 for equities and cross currency, and in the US it was 102 for was the standard, and it's been there ever since. There's been lots of talk about moving, depending on the type of securities being lent or the securities being taken as collateral, the margin going higher. I do know that if you take equities as collateral, people require 110 or 115. Again, if there is a lot of that on the tri-party side, as probably if you're familiar with that, but certainly what we deem non-cash collateral, very, very definite haircut changes depending on what collateral is being received.
Mark, can you speak at all to the $50 billion in the write-downs in the securities lending portfolio by the end of 2008? Or is that just, are you not the right person?
No, unfortunately not. I wasn't really involved in any of that activity. Is there anything specific or...
Well, I mean, I guess earlier we were talking about you estimated the size, and maybe you were just using hypothetical numbers that AIG had $100 billion in securities to lend out, and at any one time, it probably had $50 billion lent out. I know it's not directly because you would have invested in other things, and there would have been some money going back and forth and money interest and stuff being paid, but if you could give maybe a better sense of the size of the securities being lent out, I'm just trying to square the $50 billion in losses.
Sure.
And figure out what percentage that would have been, like a decline in value in the investments.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I can't really be more accurate on the losses side, but on the certainly on the balances, we were, I think, around about 07, we would have been, so, you know, August 07, we was, I think, in the region of $70 billion on loan. I think we had something like $160 billion available to lend.
Okay.
So we still knew we could grow quite a lot.
We've got you at about $82 billion at the end of December.
Yeah, I think, well, we actually, I think we peaked at something like 94 in October of 08, of 07. And then the balances started coming off gradually. And again, I think there was a view that they wanted, people wanted to wind the program down, get, you know, reduce down balances as we could, as and when we could. So whilst remaining, you know, above this 20% liquidity number.
Right.
So those were sort of like the figures that I recall. We went from sort of 70 to 90 in the period of a couple of months, really just to give ourselves a cushion of liquidity.
I see. That was done to get more liquidity.
I'm sorry?
This, going from 70 to 90 in a couple of months was done to get more liquidity.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And that was in that August, September, October 2007 time frame?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
What's the current,
from my memory.
What's the current state of affairs for the securities lending program?
Well, the current state of affairs is the program has been completely wound down now. All loans have been closed. The last loan closed around about the 29th of March this year. All the clients have been, you know, have received their securities back. All the collateral accounts have been closed out, and we're just in the process of revoking license and winding down the program.
I see. So it's lucky we got you when we did.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm actually, you know, sadly, we made redundant most of the team, and there are a few of us still around, but we've been deployed into new areas, so.
I see.
If we wanted to take away lessons learned, I guess, from this episode of AIG, and we wanted to be objective, what were some of the lessons that we could learn from what happened?
That's a really good question, and something that I probably would want to sort of like sit in a dark room and think hard about. I think we've learned a lot. I would say, you know, was our model correct? You know, did we go too fast, too high, too quickly? I think we should have, you know, the In every business, and I think throughout Wall Street, there's a need to, you know, produce year-on-year returns better than the last year. And I think that sometimes you have to look at the model and say, you know, are we achieving that with all the tools we have at our hands? Clearly, we had a big pool of assets. We'd added a lot of counterparts clients into the program, and we were able to lend those assets in the commingled pool. I think, you know, that all worked fine. The investments, you know, we definitely, you know, there was a view that these were highly rated, liquid assets, and, you know, senior investment professionals, risk professionals reviewed these guidelines, and they felt that they were appropriate for the investment pools. I think, you know, my concern is I think the size grew too much. I don't think we should have been as big, and we should have controlled that side. I think also the factor that, you know, the returns we get on investments, certainly as we came through the towards 2004-05 were reducing. You know, the spreads were narrowing, and when spreads narrow and you have to still return, you know, the same as last year plus a bit more, you've got to increase your volume. And so there was a you know, view that that's the way you had to go. And I think that should also have told us, you know, maybe the signal is, you know, we don't want to increase. We're making, you know, we always refer to this as a low risk, low return business. You know, you get incremental return for as little as no to no risk as possible. Now, you know, that clearly was everybody's view from top down. But when you get a systemic situation like we had, and you can't sell anything, and AIG, who was deemed an extremely good credit coming into 2007, you know, you never expected all these things to happen. And I think this the lesson is, you know, we should have probably looked harder at our guidelines and maybe taken some rain checks when we felt the spreads were narrowing, and not climbed too quickly.
Mr. Hutching, it sort of raises an interesting point here, even though you're challenged by having the lights on, that it sounds like the time you started taking the most risk were not when interest rates were really low, but when interest rates had risen and the yield curve had flattened. And so the spread between your investment returns and what you're paying to borrow the funds was compressed. And that's when you went out and perhaps invested in ABS and other instruments that were more risky than you had done in 2000 through 2004.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's an easy to pull draw that conclusion. I think one thing to bear in mind, and the investment guidelines got tweaked over time. And, I mean, you might say, well, you know, going from 66 to 75 is a big tweak. But, you know, the fact is that the asset backs were always in the program from 99. In fact, the external program I mentioned right at the very beginning that was outsourced to Wall Street portfolio advisors had asset backs in their cash collateral guidelines, and in fact had a double A rating instead of triple A. And in fact, we increased it to triple A when we brought them in house. The portfolio, I think it was in I know you sent or you provide, or I got a copy of the 03 changes, went from 50% to 66. So it's still 4 years before the crisis hit, but 2 years beyond 2003, they moved them from 66 to 75. So, you know,
when did that
over
happen?
A period of time. I think the percentage was 50% back in 99, or even when we brought the program in house.
Yes.
It went to 66% in 2003.
Right.
And then 75% in December 2005. So, yes, it would sound, you know, someone said, you know, we've got 75% in asset backs. It wasn't that they were suddenly, bang, you went into asset backs 75%. It was a gradual increase over a long period, a number of years. And I think the fact that we went into asset backs, and again, I'm only going from recollection, you'd probably need to speak to the investment professionals on this, but my recollection was, again, these were giving us a good return based on the credit rating and the liquidity. So it was better than we were getting in maybe some other asset classes.
Similarly rated
but
corporates, for example.
The point was also to make sure that the program was reasonably diverse, and therefore it had to have a mix of corporate bonds. But I know that, and you rightly said, when we found that the curve was declining and we were getting we weren't able to invest you know, corporate bonds, we were able to pick up in 2000 we were buying corporate bonds at LIBOR plus 30. Double A corporate bonds was nice pickup, and we were lending them out at rebates of say LIBOR, so we were making a 30 basis point spread on that in 2000. 5 years later, we probably, those bonds would have matured and we'd had to put them back to work, put the cash back out to invest, and the same company was then issuing at LIBOR plus 2 or LIBOR plus 4, and therefore our spread, instead of 30, was now 2 to 4 basis points. So, you know, it was a case of where can we continue to try and, you know, buy that 2 to 4, because obviously that's still above where we're paying, but where else can we add some value? And I think, you know, on a the investment managers gave plenty of feedback, and the decision was taken to, and obviously the CIOs at the time suggested to, you know, take a little bit of extra by investing a little bit more in asset backs and put a little bit more out, a couple, lengthen the duration a tad. And obviously that was just, you know, a percentage. The rest of the pot was still in the shorter duration, and also the AAA.
Would you agree?
I think it points to the fact that, yes, you know, they, you know, it was a case of trying to get extra return, but utilizing, you know, what they felt as appropriate investments.
Sir, would you agree that there was an inherent asset liability mismatch? Or would that be a fair depiction of the business model?
I'm not on the investment side, so I wouldn't know if that. My view was that we were always under the impression these were high liquid, highly rated, and we could sell them tomorrow, and you know, if needed. It was down to the investment professionals to make that decision as to whether this was a good investment based on the fact that we had no more than sort of 1 month liabilities rolling off at any one time, liabilities rolling off at any one time. So, you know, the view was, again, that you don't worry so much about the liability side, because we can always raise cash by lending more securities. And we're going to be in this business a very long time. We've got, big insurance companies with lengthy liabilities, we can continue on this course for as long as we want. We just don't want to take too much risk, and I think their view was too much risk was going down to things like single A, or putting all your eggs in one basket. And I know that sounds probably very crass, but you know, not putting everything into aspects,
right,
or into subprime.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you very much. I think that's all the questions we have for now. Certainly, if we have any follow-up questions after we review our notes, we'll let Stacy and Rob know and perhaps follow up with you. But I think that you have covered things well for us from your perspective. So thank you very much for your time.
That's okay. You're more than welcome.
Great. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.